Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutub.
Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then we consider what you know of the news of the day. Now, despite the vaccination surge and endless lockdowns, it seems that deaths and hospitalization from COVID-19 remain stubbornly high. And unsurprisingly, this is driving public frustration. What's working and what's not in the way the pandemic is currently managed? And what approaches need to be reconsidered? Let's ask what Dr. Kumita Tevadas thinks. She's a virologist with the University Science Malaysia. Dr. Kumita, thank you so much for joining us on the show tonight. I'm wondering, why aren't we seeing an improvement in the battle against COVID? I mean, it feels like things are so much worse today than they were a year and a half ago. And we don't seem to be winning this fight despite all our valiant efforts. In fact, it seems that we're losing this fight quite badly. Why is that?
A lot of different reasons, really. So right now, when we think about cases, a lot of cases that we are seeing are sporadic cases. So what that means is we can't link them to a particular cluster. So that actually makes it very difficult to quickly isolate people. And that also sort of suggests that we're not doing enough testing. So that's probably a lot of people out there who are infected and they don't know it and they're sort of transmitting it to other people. But I think the sort of obvious answer of what we are battling right now is definitely the Delta variant. So in comparison to the original strain that we saw a year and a half ago, just to put into context, you had to be in close contact with someone for about 15 minutes to actually be able to transmit it to someone. Whereas with Delta, you just need a couple of seconds. So in that time that I actually took to say that sentence, I've probably already, you know, infected a lot of people. And it's also known to be a lot more contagious as chickenpox. And also the viral load is a lot higher. So you would get faster spreading, it's more transmissible, it's more aggressive. So we sort of have to think a little bit about how we might change our SOPs in dealing with this new variant.
Kumita, you were quoted as, you know, kind of predicting a rise in infections. And I wonder if you could help us understand what brought you to that conclusion. How as a scientist, were you looking at the dynamics? What factors did you put into the equation that you used to come up with a sense of what might happen in the future?
Okay, so there were a lot of different parameters that went into it. The first one was definitely, so I work with COVID. So on a daily basis, what we saw was we were getting very large clusters in a very short period of time. So that sort of was sort of a red flag to say, okay, we are dealing with something really dangerous. You know, that wasn't quite successfully captured in the genomic surveillance that we were doing in Malaysia. So that also sort of told us that maybe we were not doing enough genomic surveillance, genomic sequencing to sort of know what's in the community. And then we also started seeing, you know, a lot of different sort of demographic. We saw kids being infected. We never used to see that at the beginning of the pandemic. So for us, it was a red flag. And then, of course, as mentioned earlier, Delta has a really high viral load. So once we see that, we sort of know, again, you know, this suggests that we would be seeing a huge spike in cases. And that's sort of what we're seeing right now, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's important that you kind of, you know, are anticipating some of the red flags that could come along the way. And I'm just wondering, Dr. Kumita, whether you have enough data as a scientist and you have sufficient data to, you know, create these types of predictive models and to anticipate the way the disease is spreading, the changing dynamics of this disease.
So it really helped that Ministry of Health recently, they put up GitHub, which is an open platform, and there's a lot of information out there, and together with WHO, they release a weekly epidemiology report, which sort of tells you the trends going on in our neighboring countries. And again, you know, sort of piecing together all this information, you know, again, together with things like vaccine efficacy, it actually does sort of tell us, okay, are we potentially going to be dealing with a new variant? Is that something that we should be aware of? At the moment, it looks like Delta is the worst enemy that we are dealing with. And, you know, sort of looking at what some other countries went through, for example, India, they had a very steep increase in cases and also a very steep decline. So we're sort of hoping that that is what we will see in Malaysia as well.
Kavita, do you make a distinction between infection, you know, by the virus as opposed to disease, severe disease, and, you know, including, you know, intubation or ICU care? Are those distinctions important to keep in mind when we talk about the dynamics here?
Yes, definitely. So I think especially when the cases increase, so the data that we always have is always at the point of diagnosis. So we unfortunately don't have the data of how quickly someone may decline if, say, they were category one, someone who's asymptomatic, or category two, if they had mild symptoms, to three, four, or five, where they would need hospitalizations. But when looking at the numbers, definitely the more important number to look at would be who falls into categories 3, 4, and 5, because that actually tells us how well our healthcare is coping. So in general, we usually have about 1.9 to 2% of patients who falls into the last three categories. But if you sort of do some quick calculation, that's still about 400 people or so that we're dealing with every day. And we saw that huge surge in Klang Valley, and now we're sort of seeing that spread to like the northern region and the other states in Malaysia. So the good thing is that, you know, vaccination rates are increasing, but we also need a lot of other public health measures to control for the virus.
Right. Okay. So I one of the numbers that concern me the most is the number of brought in dead patients. And I'm just wondering what questions those numbers raise for you.
Okay, so I think for me, what was really worrying about the BID cases is that 80% of the cases were actually not diagnosed with COVID. So they didn't know they had COVID. And this could be either because they didn't have access to diagnosis, or they were afraid to come forward to be tested. So, you know, and I guess the population that you would think of is maybe people who live in rural areas or maybe undocumented migrant workers. So that's very worrying. And, you know, 80% is really high, and there may be more out there. The remaining 20% of BIDs that we did see, they were actually asymptomatic or they were mild. So they were told to self-quarantine at home. And even though now we have, you know, like a virtual way of assessing whether patients are okay, according to a recent report from Klang Valley, only 50% of patients actually are sort of vigilant about updating their status. So that's something that hopefully everyone is good about, to sort of know that, you know, by keying in the information, you're helping yourself. And, you know, hopefully we will see a decrease in BID with time as well.
Yeah, speaking of decreasing numbers, you've been quoted saying vaccinations are key to bringing down the numbers of those infected. When, I guess, is the question for many people, because we are part of the surge now. You know, politicians talk about, 80% people vaccinated and so on and so forth. But is there a question of time? Should we have a more realistic timeline in terms of when we see the numbers turn around and go in the opposite direction?
So I think initially when we started thinking about the percentage of people that should be vaccinated, 80% was sort of this number that people typically think of to achieve herd immunity. But what we're seeing with COVID right now is that it might be quite challenging, if not impossible, to achieve herd immunity. I suspect, you know, with Delta variant and, you know, other variants out there, it is something that we may have to live with forever. But it's just that with vaccination, the hope is that, you know, we will get people to, even if they are infected, to be mild or asymptomatic, and at least that will help what's going on in the hospital. So according to the prediction, as you know, based on how fast we are vaccinating people right now, we should expect to see things get a bit better by October.
Okay, well, that's hopefully soon. I'm just wondering, Dr. Kamita, my last question to you is, I understand you work with testing as well, and I'm wondering, what should we be reconsidering in our approach to testing?
Okay, that's actually a really good question. So I think we are seeing people be a bit more aware right now. So, you know, if they think they've been, or they know they've been in contact with someone who's positive, they do quickly come in to get tested. But what we are also seeing is, say, for example, they were in contact with someone on Sunday, they come in to get tested on Monday, and that's too short of a time frame. So because of that really short duration, they would definitely test negative. And then they would go out and assume things are okay, have, you know, large meetings and whatnot. But in reality, if you are infected with the Delta variant, the PCR test would only be able to pick up that you're infected on day 3 or day 4. If you're infected with the non-Delta variant, so like Alpha or Beta, you would pick that up on day 6. So I think, you know, I think something that people should be aware of is it might be good to give it a bit of time. Sometimes we only pick it up on day 14. That's why there's that whole 2-week period of quarantine, you know, being in quarantine. And, you know, hopefully that's something that people, you know, if they listen to this talk, that they might be more aware of.
Yeah, that's very helpful. Thank you so much for sharing that information with us. Dr. Kamita Thevadas there joining us on the show. We're going to take a quick break here and consider this. But after this, we'll come back and talk to independent health policies specialist Dr. Kosri King. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Thank you so much for staying with Sharad and I on Consider This. The public can't be faulted if it perceives a disconnect between the public health policies that have been taken, like, you know, the lockdowns and the vaccination surge capacity program, with the increasing rate of infections, severe COVID cases and deaths. What is going wrong, we ask. Independent health policies specialist Dr. Kosri King joins us on the line now. Sri King, a pleasure to have you back on the show. Point blank question, in terms of pandemic management, what is it that we're doing wrong?
Melissa, we're starting with a very difficult question. There are some things that are outside of our control, so I think we can begin there. Global vaccine supplies are short. Secondly, the Delta variant is highly aggressive. Thirdly, Malaysia may be reaping the problems of an underfunded healthcare system since the 1980s and 90s, a contract doctor system, and indeed contract nurse, contract pharmacist, contract everything since 2016 as well. So these are things that are outside of our control, and we can forgive the government for not being able to manage these things. But for many other areas, perhaps in three specific areas, it's a bit difficult to see how in the last 20 months we still have not yet had good public health solutions, good public administration solutions, and good public policy solutions. Let me give some examples, Melissa and Sharad, of good public health solutions that even after 18, 20 months of fighting COVID, we're still nowhere near it. Firstly is testing. We don't have a reconciled strategy for rapid tests with PCR tests. Ventilation is a second example where Malaysia is a bit late to come up with ventilation guidelines, and it was great that one was announced about 2 weeks ago. The third example could be vaccination for pregnant mothers. Previously, it was 14 to 33 weeks, but only today or yesterday it's been enlarged to at any time point in gestation. So the point I'm making is, from a public health and a healthcare perspective, we have not been making enough good choices. from a public administration perspective, Melissa, there's a lot of discoordination, too many agencies. The National Recovery Plan is too dynamic. When we say dynamic, what they're actually doing is changing the criteria almost on the fly without providing enough evidence to support these changes. And perhaps finally, we're not decisive enough in our political choices. We wasted a lot of months last year when we had very few cases. We could have used that time to rebuild our system and to provide rest to our system and also to institute the system changes that are necessary for us to succumb to overcome a wave X. So there you have it, Melissa. Maybe it's not one, but maybe it's a problem of public health, public administration, and also public policy.
Speaking, I mean, is the lost time something we can make good? If today or tomorrow decisions are made about, the various things that you mentioned, can we make up for lost time?
Yes and no, Sharad. We can, and some lost time will always be under the bridge, water under the bridge, and we can't make up for that. And even if the best of policies are instituted, and when I say the best of policies, we don't need rocket science. We just need basic pandemic management. And basic pandemic management is common sense and a basket of solutions that we can learn from other countries as well. It's been 20 months. If it's in the first month, we can be forgiven for being a little, shall we say, scrambling. But after 20 months, we should have things in place. But Sharad, even with the best of implementation today, we don't need more advisors, but what we probably need is a bunch of action takers. Decision makers and action takers rather than a group of advisors. But even with the best of implementation, Sharad, it is possible that we'll need a washout period. We can call it anything that we want. So let me use a washout period of 2-3 months maybe for the current, wave to sort of dissipate, and we must institute a bunch of short-term actions while at the same time buying that time so that we can institute a bunch of long-term actions as well. Sharad, that's a long answer to your question, but in short, we can and we also can't make up for lost time.
I wanted to come back to something that you said about, you know, we haven't been making good choices in terms of public health policies. I wanted to ask you if, you know, there seems to be perhaps a change in the approach that we've been taking for the past 20 months or so. You see that with the recent privileges granted for those who are vaccinated. Speaking, is that the right kind of pivot? Is that the recalibration that we should be taking?
Melissa, yes, in short, it should be a kind of recalibration that we should be taking. But allow me to take a step back and then a step forward. To take a step back is to ask ourselves, why are we taking that step? Is it part of a coherent strategy for the government to move towards an endemic COVID? And if that's the case, then we should take that step because it's part of a coherent long-term strategy aligned with the National Recovery Plan and consistent with some long-term strategy that we have in mind. And that would be a great reason to provide vaccine privileges. That's to take a step back and to ask ourselves, why are we providing vaccine privileges? Is it a populist move? Is it a move because we think it's actually good? Is it a tactical short-term move without thinking about the long-term consequences, or is it truly part of a coherent long-term strategy? That's me taking a step back. But let me take a step forward, Melissa. The timing is probably wrong for a few reasons, and the Malaysian Health Coalition has written about this as well. Firstly, Malaysia has only vaccinated 29% of our entire population, 32 million. We're not even counting the undocumented migrants yet. So at 29% of population coverage for vaccination, that's probably a little low. Chile moved out at 50, and Singapore is targeting to move out at 70% entire population, not just adult population. The second reason is at 29%, it's still hiding a wide range. States like Sabah are about 13 to 17% coverage, and other states like Labuan are a little higher, perhaps at about 60 to 70%. Given the wide range in vaccination coverage between states in Malaysia, it would be counterproductive perhaps if we were to adopt this particular timing. And then thirdly, naturally, we see that we have thousands of daily cases, hundreds of daily deaths, including 93, a quite high number of those who are brought in dead. And finally, the Delta variant means that even if you're vaccinated, it will provide good protection against the Delta variant. But without adequate genomic surveillance, we simply don't know whether or not it's truly safe for us to open up. Timing is always going to be difficult, so we will never be able to find the perfect timing, but now perhaps it's not the right one.
Suiking, do you think public health policies are complicated by sort of social and economic realities. Malaysia is not a first world country by any means in terms of people's resilience or the government's ability to fund and support businesses and workers, and that somehow that undermines the resolve to kind of keep focused on the public health issue, that somehow the government has to address these other issues as well.
Shara, this is a great question and observation. Can I share a bit of history and then maybe make a comment about the very social nature of this pandemic? SARS happened in 2003. SARS only had 8,000 cases, 800 deaths over 8 months. This is an approximate oversimplification. Before SARS, it was all about border control for a pandemic. After SARS, it was prevent and detect at source. After Ebola, it was healthcare systems that needed to be able to surge, to provide surge capacity for healthcare. That was after Ebola in 2014. After COVID, when we think of the next pandemic after COVID, we will have to think of something called health in all policies, which means that the MOH or the Ministry of Health itself alone is unable to care for us during a pandemic. We'll need the Ministry of Human Resources, Rural Development Ministry, Community Development, Women and Family Development, the Ministry of Finance, the Treasury. All government ministries need to help us manage this pandemic and also for the future pandemics as well. COVID is perhaps the first social pandemic in the sense that infectious diseases principles, signs, ventilators, intensive care units are all completely inadequate for us to care for this pandemic and also for future ones. So as Malaysia battles an endemic COVID, we will probably have to institute a lot more health in all policies and to be much more holistic in our policy making, instead of only requiring the Ministry of Health to become, shall we say, a hero or to play magic in order to do last gasp saving measures for us. So to repeat myself is to say that the Health Ministry alone is not enough.
Do you think, Sui King, that living with COVID is the right way forward?
It will be, and it is, Melissa, sorry, to answer your question in short. It's been 20 months, this pandemic is not going anywhere, and indeed, the virus that originally came from China just about 20 months ago is mutating, alpha, beta, lambda, kappa, and so on and so forth. And this does not appear to be going anywhere. So I think many scientists are already preparing for the long haul. There are maybe two groups of people who are not ready to prepare for the long haul. So when I say scientists are ready, I mean public health physicians, infectious diseases specialists, and epidemiologists will prepare for the long haul. And when I say long haul, it could be indefinite. But perhaps two groups of people are not yet prepared for the long haul. The first one is politicians or political leaders, and secondly, the general public. Political leaders perhaps think that we can go back to the old normal because to prepare for endemic COVID requires very difficult and also very expensive political choices. And it's always easy to go back to the old normal or to seduce ourselves with the thought of going back to the old normal because making endemic COVID choices are difficult and expensive. And the general population cannot really be faulted for wanting to go back to the old normal because it's so much more comfortable back there.
Speaking, you know, we have been looking at numbers, the population as a whole, looking at the infection numbers and the death numbers. And I'm wondering if there's a point at which we will come to be numb to these numbers. We'll expect that, you know, on a daily basis, we will have deaths in the hundreds. Is that something that we might sort of realistically expect, that we will be having these kinds of numbers for the short to the medium term?
Shara, unfortunately, I think it's quite likely that we will see these numbers of thousands of cases and hundred scores, so perhaps 100 or 200 deaths a day. Hopefully it will end very soon. But it's possible, in fact, even likely that we will see these numbers for at least the next 4 to 6 weeks or so. It is possible that we're even undercounting that 20,000 cases is an undercounted number. The Deputy Director General of Health has come up to say that it's possible that there are 3 to 4 times more cases out there that are just simply not caught or detected by our public health system. So these numbers are probably here to stay for some period of time. Sharad, I think that numbness is tragic. One death is a tragedy, but a million deaths becomes a statistic. We've got 1.3 million cases right now, more than 10,000 deaths. We need to do some drastic measures in order to arrest these numbers in the short term so that we can stop the surge as quickly as possible, but also to not waste any more time so that we can institute the necessary long-term actions and also prepare for a potential future wave.
Good. Speaking, I just want to ask you if there's a possible silver lining in terms of the developments in medical science, that we have this extraordinary warp speed, to use that unfortunate term, development of vaccines, and now there looks to be perhaps cures, meaning therapeutic drugs that could actually cure somebody of a COVID infection. Do you think that might be the game changer, that is drugs ultimately that might help us overcome this terrible virus and the disease it causes?
Sharat, this is a great question and a difficult one to answer. So we have to look at it in a few ways. The first one is, it's fortunate that a small minority of people who get COVID develop stage 4 or stage 5 COVID, which is very serious, requiring intensive care and ventilation support. And these are the people who would benefit from these medicines at the moment. So there have been some medicines that have been approved, including antibodies that have been provided to patients in order to reduce their risk of dying from COVID. And all that is great. The challenge to that is that these medicines are usually quite expensive, and as far so far in Malaysia, no one medicine I think has been approved for the treatment of COVID, or rather that has been proven to cure COVID with a high degree of certainty, at least in Malaysia. So the cost is one thing, the access to these medicines is another, and that's on the therapeutic side. The longer we have COVID, the more science will have time in order to have patients as well as the funding necessary for us to come up with a breakthrough cure that could be accessible as well as reasonably cost effective. On the vaccine side, Sharat, I think it's great that we've vaccinated 4.5 billion doses of the vaccine have been given out to human beings since the start of the program in December 2020. The challenge with vaccination is obviously vaccine equity. Only about 1.2% of these doses were given over to low and middle income countries. In Malaysia, vaccine equity is a reasonably small issue, fortunately for us, although we can still do better to increase the vaccination rates in places like Sabah as well as the east coast of Peninsula, right. Malaysia. With variants coming, we may need a second shot, a booster shot, or second generation vaccines.
Okay, thank you so much, Sri King. Always, always a pleasure speaking with you. That was Independent Health Policies Specialist, Dr. Koh Sri King. That's all we have for you on this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutan, signing off for the evening.
Thank you so much for watching. Good night.